Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. I'm Jordan Edwards, Communications Associate at the BJC. Today we're discussing the Supreme Court case, Zubik v. Burwell, the latest challenge to the Affordable Care Act. Here with me is BJC General Counsel Holly Holman. Holly, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
So Holly, let's start by just explaining the case. So how would you explain the case to those listening?
Zubik versus Burwell is the name given to really seven cases that are consolidated for review before the High Court dealing with the contraceptive mandate of the Affordable Care Act. So the contraceptive mandate is that part of the Affordable Care Act that says that most employer-provided health care plans have to provide for no-cost contraceptives to their employees, and it includes a wide range of contraceptives.
So what is the BJC's position in this case?
Well, the BJC is involved in this case because at issue is a specific religious accommodation that was provided for the religious nonprofits that are suing in this case. As our listeners know, the Baptist Joint Committee is dedicated to the free exercise of religion and no establishment of a religion. That's how we protect religious liberty in America. And the Baptist Joint Committee is particularly interested in the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, a statute that's involved in this case. The plaintiffs in this case, they're called petitioners at the Supreme Court because they lost in the circuit courts below, have been given a way to be accommodated about their religious objection to providing contraceptives. But they say that that accommodation burdens their free exercise of religion, and so they brought this case under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The BJC's interest is in RFRA, as the statute's known, being interpreted in a way that provides not only great protection for religion, but longevity for religious exemptions. And so we're very concerned with the claims that are being brought and how the court might treat them based upon the statutory scheme that's provided in RFRA.
Now, we filed a friend of the court brief in this case, authored by Douglas Laycock, one of our longtime partners. We didn't submit our own brief in the Hobby Lobby case, so why did you think this case was important enough to file a brief in?
Well, the Baptist Joint Committee is very interested in all free exercise cases and RFRA cases and following how the courts will interpret the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. This particular case is of interest because it deals with how an exception to a law could be provided for religious objectors and how it could be interpreted. In this case, the BJC sees these petitioners as taking RFRA too far. They, in fact, object to an accommodation that was particularly designed to address their religious beliefs against certain contraceptives, or in some case, some petitioners oppose all contraceptives. And what they're objecting to is not being asked to pay for or contract for those services. That was the claim in Hobby Lobby. These religious objectors in the Zubik case are challenging an accommodation that says they don't have to pay or contract for contraceptives for their employees, but the government will use their secular insurance companies to do that. Basically, this is a bridge too far, a claim that goes too far, and if successful under some of the theories that they have proposed, would do real damage to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
So, in other words, these groups are saying that Hobby Lobby wasn't accommodating enough. The decision in Hobby Lobby wasn't accommodating enough.
Exactly. In Hobby Lobby, it was a different case in that you had for-profit employers objecting to the contraceptive mandate, again, out of sincerely held religious beliefs against certain kinds of contraceptives. But for-profit companies didn't have any kind of exemption or accommodation under the law. The government had not thought about and provided a way for them to avoid conflicts between their conscience and the important needs of employees to have access to health care benefits. In Hobby Lobby, the court said that indeed the company, a closely held for-profit company, was entitled under RFRA to relief from the contraceptive mandate. And the way they got there was by saying, look, you provided this accommodation for religious entities that takes care of religious objections while still providing employees with the benefits that were designed for them. So in Hobby Lobby, the court said, look, the government has done this for religious entities, so you could do that for Hobby Lobby. And they said, in that way, it's sort of a win-win. The cost to the employees is absolutely zero because the employees will have access to the full range of contraceptives, and Hobby Lobby doesn't have to pay or contract for it. So they pointed to the exact accommodation that is now at issue in the Zubik case. The religious employers in Zubik say it's not enough for the government to provide an accommodation that gets them out of paying and contracting for the services. They, in fact, want the government not to invoke their powers against the secular insurance companies to provide that contraceptive coverage separately. So the way the accommodation works is that a religious employer who has a sincerely held objection to providing contraceptives for its employees lets the government know that, or lets their insurance company know that. And then the accommodation goes into effect through a different means. The insurance company then would have the duty to provide the contraceptive coverage, the part that the employer objects to, for the employees, so that the employees still get that, but the employer doesn't have to pay for it.
So these religious employers don't have to pay for the contraceptives. What is their complaint?
So the case involves a lot of different kinds of religious employers, from individuals to Roman Catholic dioceses to Catholic charities to religious primary schools and universities. All of these religious employers have some kind of objection to the contraceptive mandate. Some may object to all contraceptive coverage, and some maybe to only certain kinds that they view as akin to abortion. In order to succeed under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, a plaintiff has to assert that the government has substantially burdened their religious exercise. If they get past that first hurdle, then the government has to show that they have a compelling interest in doing so. Mm-hmm. And that they've exercised that compelling interest by the least restrictive means. Mm-hmm. So in lay terms, that means if you can show that the government incidentally burdens your religion, harms it in some significant way, and that's based upon your sincerely held religious beliefs, then the government has to show it has a good reason for doing that. There's no question that in this case, the government was not trying to regulate religion. This is part of a huge health care law. The contraceptive mandate is part of a big part of that law, which is focused on preventative health care services. And it happens to be that an important part of preventive health care for women is access to contraceptives.
You mentioned the term substantial burden. That's kind of the buzzword being thrown around in this case. So you don't think that these employers, that the government doesn't impose a substantial burden on their religion?
You know, there are different ways that these petitioners talk about the substantial burden on their religious exercise. At the heart of the matter is an objection to contraceptives on the one hand, and on the other hand, the government interest in providing no-cost access to contraceptives for the employees. So these two things are in conflict, and then the law here is asking, is there a substantial burden on the religious exercise being asserted? So the petitioners, the religious entities here, have to assert that the accommodation at issue burdens their religious exercise. So you could look at it as saying, some of them have said earlier they don't want to be involved in the process, that by completing a form that states their objection, that triggers the government's process to go after the secular insurance companies to provide the contraceptives. Sometimes it's phrased in other ways where it's not so focused on the paperwork, but on the idea that they are part of a larger system that's going to eventually lead to contraceptives for their employees. The petitioners now before the Supreme Court, the way they put it is that they have an interest in not letting the government use their infrastructure, basically their insurance plans, their insurance relationship with their employees in order to provide the offending coverage. The way the accommodation works, of course, is that once the employer objects, the employees learn that the employer is not going to provide it. Instead, the contraceptives are coming directly from the insurance company without the approval or involvement or payment of the employer. So the government's made a sophisticated, careful system to meet this conflict between those who object to the contraceptives and the government's interest in making sure that they're available for the employees.
So, Holly, how might this case harm the Religious Freedom Restoration Act?
The Religious Freedom Restoration Act is a very important federal statute that was passed in 1993. At the time, it had broad bipartisan support across the ideological and political spectrum and religious spectrum. The Baptist Joint Committee, in fact, led the Coalition for Free Exercise of Religion that helped push this act in Congress. And it's really important that the court gives its full intent and meaning. It has a careful structure that first the plaintiff has to show a substantial burden on religious exercise that's informed by a sincerely held religious belief. That's kind of an entry point, and it needs to have some meaning before it triggers the other part of the statute where the government has to show that it has a compelling interest. One threat in this case is that the courts get the first part of that calculation wrong and defer entirely to a plaintiff's view of how their religion is substantially burdened. If that happens, then the government always has to have this high burden to prove that the regulation or the law at issue is of this highest importance to the government. And I'm afraid that's too high a burden on the government, so that religious freedom will lose because support for religious freedom and the exemptions that are part of the American religious freedom tradition will be seen as tipping too far in favor of religious entities and against all other interests.
So tell me more about the brief that the BJC filed with the court. What does it say?
The BJC filed a brief that was written by Professor Douglas Laycock of the University of Virginia Law School and one of the nation's leading experts on religious liberty to make two points. One, we were very concerned about the definition and court's use and an explanation of substantial burden. Substantial burden, of course, is the first trigger to activating RFRA protection. The plaintiff has to have a substantial burden on their religious exercise that's caused by the government. We were concerned about arguments being made in the case that define substantial burden in a way that is too easy to meet, that really causes it to lose all meaning. Secondly, we were concerned, and the second point of our brief is to address an argument that the petitioners made that they had to be accommodated in the way that they wanted to be accommodated. Okay? The government provided a system of exemptions to ensure that it could best meet the importance of religious liberty while at the same time meeting its government needs of providing health care benefits to employees. And first, the government provided an exemption for churches and their integrated auxiliaries. It's not very well known to lay people, but it's an established line sort of that church-state lawyers would know or people who represent religious entities, a line that protects houses of worship and entities that are most closely related to them. The government recognized that contraceptives can be and are for some religious groups an important and religiously sensitive matter. And so they said, we're not going to apply this to those groups. Churches that oppose contraceptives have an automatic exemption. Of course, many churches would provide these to employees, other churches wouldn't. So that's one exemption. Then the government went further because in the process, the rulemaking process, they got a lot of feedback. They said, what about all these other religious employers, bigger than houses of worship, these charities and universities and other kinds of religious entities that also object to contraceptives? And they come out of the same religious traditions as these churches that oppose contraceptives. And so the government came up with this accommodation that we've been talking about. Unfortunately, the petitioners in this case say that the fact that there was this narrow exemption, the fact that that exists, means that it must exist for them. In other words, they challenge the idea that the government can exempt religious groups in ways that are of the government's choosing to meet certain needs, as opposed to what the plaintiffs say they want. They ask for an absolute exemption, the same as houses of worship, and basically make the argument that because they're not covered, then it is an irrational line and the government's interest cannot be compelling.
What would you say, just, you know, talking to someone who had concerns about this case, for someone who believes that this is the government going after nuns or going after religious people or Christians, why is that inaccurate?
This case does require sort of a basic understanding about religious liberty and how the law protects religious liberty. I'm hopeful that this case will make some people maybe think about that for the first time. We are so fortunate in America to have the kind of religious freedom that not just that doesn't only protect our right to profess our beliefs, but also to act on our religious beliefs. And this case is one that says, how far does a government have to go to accommodate your religious beliefs when weighed against other important interests? I think it's important, as people look at this case, to recognize that our Constitution protects religious freedom, and federal statutes protect religious freedom, and they do it in a pretty good way in that we allow exemptions to general laws, laws that aren't targeted at religion, but that incidentally harm religion. We often provide exceptions to that. In this case, that's exactly what happened. The government provided an exception to the contraceptive mandate to accommodate the religious objectors. And the question is, did the government go far enough? One way to see this case is a test on the limits of religious accommodation. We are fortunate that we have the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act that requires government to have a good reason if it's going to substantially harm someone's religion, even if that's incidental. But it has to have some limits, and it has to have a structure, the statutory structure, so that it makes sense. Essentially, in this case, the religious entities are arguing that the government cannot regulate their secular insurance companies.
Holly, we're recording this podcast not long after the passing of Justice Scalia. So now there are 8 justices currently on the court for the March 23rd oral arguments of Zubik v. Burwell. What would happen if the justices tied, if it was a 4-4 decision?
If there's a 4-4 decision, that means there's no majority opinion, then the opinions of the circuit courts remain the way they are. And so in this case, you have 7 circuits, although now, since the briefing in the case, actually there are 8 circuits that have now decided in favor of the government. So the accommodation withstands the challenge under RFRA. There is one circuit. In the 8th circuit, religious employers would win. They've won, and that would be the rule of law in that circuit.
Thanks, Holly, for joining me. And thanks for listening to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. For more on Zubik v. Burwell, including a list of frequently asked questions, visit bjconline.org/Zubik. And for more BJC podcasts, visit bjconline.org/podcasts or subscribe to our iTunes channel.